thing about the story getting to the media. He wondered whether to call the colonel, but ultimately decided the man would not be helpful. He was convinced of Wingo's guilt. Maybe everyone was. But then that meant Tyler probably knew about it too. What must his son think? That he was a thief or a traitor? The news story went on to add that the missing money and soldier might have something to do with some classified operation that led all the way to the White House. However, neither President John Cole nor anyone at the Pentagon would comment, which of course was just creating a vacuum that was being filled by increasingly strident and hyperbolic voices. Then he wondered about something else. Where was Jean? Had she been pulled by the DOD after the mission overseas had gone to hell? If so, who was with Tyler? That had been the hardest thing about this whole task for Wingo. Pretending to remarry and bringing what amounted to a complete stranger home to be his son's new stepmom. But it had been unavoidable. Tyler needed a grown-up with him. Wingo had refused to leave without that condition met. Unfortunately, the simplest way to achieve it was to fake a marriage, and so he had. But he had regretted it from the very first instant Tyler had laid eyes on Jean and been told that this woman, in essence, was taking his real mother's place. Wingo turned on the TV in his room to see if there was any more news about the missing money. Every local station was chasing the same story, but it wasn't this story. There had been an explosion at a motor court in South Alexandria. The cause of the explosion was unknown as yet. But he sat up when the news anchor mentioned something else, namely that the room had been rented long-term to a Jean Shepherd, whose whereabouts were currently unknown. Jean Shepherd. That was Jean's real name. He thumbed in another message to Tyler, urgently asking his son to contact him. He waited, and then waited some more. His phone never vibrated. He debated whether to drive over to the house and see what he could find out, but that would be suicide, he knew. Yet he seriously thought about chancing it to make sure his son was okay. He contemplated Adil's email. Westerners coming into Afghanistan on a charter flight. Heron Air Service based out of Dulles, Virginia, which was not that far away. Could he maybe get a line on Tim Simons from Nebraska? It was the only lead he had right now. He rose, slipped his gun into its belt holster, and headed out. Later, from inside his car, Wingo watched a jet lift into the air away from a storm approaching from the west. It had a graceful ascent and performed a long bank to the south before leveling out and continuing its climb out from Dulles Airport. Wingo took the fork to the right and made his way to the general aviation section of the sprawling 12,000-acre airport. It had been opened in 1972, and for many years had been largely unused by the flying public, which had preferred closer-in Washington National Airport. Now, Dulles was one of the busiest terminals in the country, with short-haul flights to New York and non-stop routes to Tokyo. Its terminal roof, roughly in the shape of a wing, had been ultra-modern when it was first built, though now it looked dated. The original control tower, with the enormous pearl-white ball on top, was no longer used. It had been replaced by a new tower about 5 years ago, and there were currently 6 air traffic controllers stationed there to keep the busy area skies safe. Wingo had flown out of Dulles many times over the years. He had landed in a cargo plane here not that long ago. His name had been on the flight crew manifest, something that had cost him quite a bit of money. With private flights, the CBP, or Custom and Border Patrol agents, would meet the deplaning passengers at the front door of the fixed base operator, or FBO, operating the flight. With cargo flights, they came directly to the plane. They would check the people on board, but their chief concern was the cargo. It had been an ignominious homecoming, but at least he had arrived back in the country safely. Before the CBP agents had even arrived, he had walked directly out of the FBO into a parking lot across the street, and from there to the rental center, where he'd picked up his car. Now Wingo parked his car, partially slid down his window, and took up observation with a pair of binoculars. He kept looking around for anyone watching him. He knew there were surveillance cameras everywhere, and he tried to keep out of the direct sight lines of the ones he could see. He knew there was a ramp tower that housed individuals whose job it was to keep things safe on the ground, looking for anything out of the ordinary that would require airport security to be called in. Wingo kept low in the seat for this reason. People came and went from cargo buildings 1 through 4. These narrow warehouses, barely 60 feet deep, were home to mom-and-pop cargo consolidator companies. They packaged freight and loaded it into the bellies of planes. Heron Air Service was located next to one of these cargo facilities. In the restricted lot behind the building, Wingo could see jets of varying sizes either sitting with wheels chocked or else being prepped for departure. There was one jet heading in after taxiing off the runway. This was how the rich and well-connected flew. No security lines, no parking problems, no dealing with the little people. Wingo didn't know if Heron was simply a charter company or did any freight business, but he had situated himself to be able to see both sectors of business conducted there as best he could. Still, Dulles Airport had over 500,000 square feet of cargo warehouse space and nearly 1 million square feet of cargo ramp. Hundreds, maybe thousands of employees worked here, Wingo thought. Not to mention all the millions of people who came through as passengers. And while there might not be as many charter flights and passengers as on the commercial side of the airport, he was still looking for a needle in a haystack. Then a miracle happened right in front of him. He stiffened when he saw the man exit the offices of Heron Air Service. He wore a pilot's uniform. He headed across the parking lot to his car. Wingo snapped a picture of him with his cell phone. The man climbed into a late-model Audi. Wingo noted the license plate and took a picture of it and the car. When the man drove off, Wingo fell in behind him. The man was not Tim Simons from Nebraska, but he was one of the men in that stone building in Afghanistan. And thus he represented the best and only lead Wingo had right now to uncover what the hell was going on. Chapter 41. Do you even realize how much trouble you're in? The person asking this was not Agent McKinney. It was FBI Special Agent Dwayne Littlefield, or so said his ID badge. He had not bothered to formally introduce himself. He was in his early 40s, black, about 6 feet tall, with wide shoulders, big arms that strained against the dress shirt holding them in, and a thick, heavily veined neck. He looked strong enough to punch a hole in the metal door of the room they were in, and pissed off enough to do it. Sean and Michelle sat stonily in their chairs at the FBI's Washington Field office in downtown D.C. Tyler was not with them. He had been led to another room, they assumed, for a debrief or possibly interrogation. Littlefield leaned into Sean's face. "I asked you a question." "I assumed it was a rhetorical one," replied Sean. "But in case you were really wondering, I would say that we are duly aware of our surroundings and circumstances. Yes."
"Why in the hell did you think it was necessary to send an army of agents to come get us?"
bristled Michelle.
"Don't you have a cell phone?"
Littlefield wheeled around on her. "Are you telling me how to do my damn job?"
"Actually, yeah, I am."
"You have got some balls, lady."
"Not the first time I've heard that."
Sean said, "Let's try and keep this on a professional level. First things first, why are we here?" Littlefield stared back at Sean. "You are really asking me that to my face, really?" "Yeah, I really am." We were sitting in my house with a client, not doing anything illegal as far as I'm aware, when we looked out the window and saw Patton's Third Army surrounding the place.
Well, let me refresh your memory then, said Littlefield. He picked up a remote and pointed it at a screen hanging from one wall of the room. On the screen, an image popped up. It was Sean and then Michelle climbing down out of the wreckage of the destroyed motel room and then running off. Littlefield hit a button on the image, freezing it, then tossed the remote down on the table and said, "Nothing happens anymore where there's not someone or something around to record it." He plopped down into a chair, put his hands behind his head, and said, "So unless you're claiming that's not you on the video, you have damn sure got some explaining to do." Sean and Michelle stared at the screen and saw themselves staring back. Sean said, "Someone tried to blow us up. I don't suppose your camera got a shot of him."
"Why would somebody want to kill you?"
"Have you spoken to McKinney?"
"I know about the mall incident. I know a two-star kicked your ass in the waiting room of a hospital because you got his wife nearly killed. And I know you've got a kid for a client whose dad is MIA, and maybe for all the wrong reasons."
He leaned forward and placed his palms on the table.
"What I don't know is why to any of it. And McKinney doesn't seem to know why either."
Michelle said,
"There's a lot of that going around. We seem to have the WTF virus, too."
Littlefield glanced at her.
"Former Secret Service, both of you. Only drummed out for messing up big time."
"Ancient history," said Sean. "If you check our most recent past, you'll see we're legit and good at what we do. Lots of people will tell you that."
"They actually have, because I'm good at my job, too. And I asked around before your butts ever got to my playground."
Michelle said,
"So why are you hassling us?"
"Because you left the scene of a bombing without talking to the police. You both know better than that. What the hell were you thinking?"
Before Sean could answer, he went on, "And now the kid's stepmom is missing? So that means he's an adolescent on his own? You knew that too and didn't tell anyone."
"Sorry, I didn't realize it was our job to do your job,"
retorted Michelle. Littlefield stood and leaned against the wall, his arms folded over his chest.
"So the bottom line is, I don't know what to do with you two."
"You could release us and let us get on with our work," suggested Sean. Littlefield smiled and shook his head.
"Don't think so. Two loose cannons out there is not something I need."
"So you've been assigned to find Sam Wingo? And by the way, we're not loose cannons."
"I'm not going to tell you what I have or haven't been assigned to do."
Sean shook his head wearily. "Let's cut to the chase. You've been tasked to find Sam Wingo. This is becoming an international incident. It's too hot for DHS to handle, so the Bureau's been called in. An explosion occurred. Until it's determined to be solely from domestic sources, it's the Bureau's jurisdiction. Whatever Wingo did or didn't do over in Afghanistan has everybody over here white-knuckling their chairs and considering the impact on their careers."
"We know what he lost,"
added Michelle.
"Over 2 tons of euros, $1.3 billion in U.S. dollars.
"Who the hell told you that?" barked Littlefield.
"Sorry, lips are sealed. Secret Service drills that into you."
"And how about if I see whether a grand jury subpoena drills it out of you?"
Sean said, "We can do the macho dance so we can work together on this." Littlefield said incredulously,
"Work together? You out of your freaking mind? Does it sound like I want to partner with you?"
Michelle stood and fixed her gaze on him.
"We've been lied to, almost shot, nearly blown to hell, and pushed around by dickheads from the Army, DHS, and now the FBI. So I can tell you flat out that whether you want to partner with us or not, we're working this case. So stick that up your ass and see how it fits."
She glanced at his ID on a lanyard around his neck.
"Dwayne,"
Sean muttered, "Holy Mother of God," and put his hand over his eyes. Littlefield looked ready to pull his gun and open fire. Then he did something that made Sean glance up in amazement. The FBI agent started laughing.
You are something. I heard you were hell on wheels, but seeing it for myself, you are really something.
He sat down and grew serious as he studied them both. This shit goes so far up the food chain that it's like surfing the net and reaching the end of it. There is no higher up to go to. We heard on the TV that the White House has refused to comment, said Sean. Is that how high? Littlefield gave a barely perceptible nod. Michelle was still standing. Littlefield looked up at her and said, You gonna join the party or what? Michelle sat down.
Why send one soldier out with all that money? Who couldn't see only bad things happening with that?
Apparently everybody except the stars and bars over at the Pentagon, replied Littlefield. He opened a file in front of him. You two figured out what Wingo is, or was?
He's not an Army reservist, said Sean. Nobody exits the uniform 1 year before a full pension to take a sales job at a translator firm with DOD secretly footing the bill.
You have done your homework, said Littlefield, looking impressed.
He glanced down at the file in front of him.
You two familiar with DIA?
Defense Intelligence, like CIA but in uniform.
DIA has a bigger budget than CIA, and they actually do more in certain parts of the world, but post-9/11, the two agencies have learned to play nice. He paused. You two don't have security clearances anymore.
So just leave out the juicy parts, said Sean, and be clever enough to work them in some other way.
Littlefield chuckled. It's not a secret. It was in the papers not that long ago. DIA has bulked up its clandestine field units big time. They're working closely with Langley overseas in certain hot spots. We can all guess where those might be.
Sean said, But I didn't think DIA was authorized to conduct covert operations that went much beyond your basic intelligence gathering, drone strikes, or getting guns into the hands of our enemy's enemy.
That's true. But that's also where CIA comes in, because they are authorized to do that and a lot more. However, they've also had their budget slashed and committed some very public missteps lately. And even with defense cuts and sequestration, the DOD has the funds to do more stuff.
Michelle said,
Are you saying that CIA provides the cover of their station platforms overseas?
Littlefield broke in.
And training at the farm in Virginia.
And DIA provides the field operatives?
DIA has even copied Langley on their Persia House initiative, creating a body to merge resources on problem countries around the planet. The difficulty has been how to leave soldiers behind after their units have been called back home. One way was to take the uniform off, but not for real. Train the soldier up and deploy him directly into the field of concern with an appropriate backstory that CIA would support.
So Wingo is recruited for a mission for DIA and CIA. He sets off with €1 billion and disappears, said Sean. Michelle added,
Any idea where he is now?
Littlefield shook his head.
Still in the Middle East? India? Back in the States? Your guess is as good as mine.
Who was he supposed to meet? Asked Sean. And deliver the money to?
Been trying to get that info. So far, no answers. But we did get something in. Not in the CIA-DIA loop.
How?
Asked Michelle.
Littlefield looked disappointed by the question.
Hey, the CIA and military aren't the only ones playing overseas. The Bureau has resources there, too.
He lifted out a piece of paper from the files.
Wherever Wingo was heading to, there were bodies found. All of them had been shot.
Who were they? Asked Sean.
Muslims.
From where? Asked Sean.
Littlefield put the paper back in the file.
Don't know, but let me clarify. They weren't from any official government over there. They were insurgents.
Sean and Michelle took this in, and Sean said, Insurgents? So are you saying
Littlefield nodded, a grim look in his eyes.
The Euros from us might, and I emphasize might, be going to a group that wants to topple an Islamic government.
Which one? Asked Sean.
Don't know. We're funding Syrian rebels publicly now, with both weapons and other supplies, so I don't think it's them.
That narrows the choices, said Sean, to some really bad ones.
And if that became public, and the identity of the country?
Said Michelle.
Not good, answered Sean. Littlefield said, We've been known to send aid to the enemies of our enemies before, but we do try to keep it on the QT. In this situation, that's not a can of worms anyone wants to open. Unfortunately, this can has been partially open. Somehow the story about the money and Sam Wingo made it to the press. That's another reason we need to keep a tight lid on the kid. The press will be all over him otherwise. We have an agent with eyes on the Wingo house. There are media trucks all over the place. It's all starting. And once the press is in on the hunt, they don't quit until a bigger story comes along. And I don't see that happening. Good thing we got Tyler out of there when we did, noted Sean.
But the money never made it to where it was supposed to go,
said Michelle.
Apparently not. Either Sam Wingo stole it, or somebody took it from him.
And why are you really looping us in on all this? Said Sean. I doubt it was my partner's eloquence about sticking something up your... Well, you get the point.
It wasn't her eloquence, although it was good, I have to admit. It was the kid.
What about him? Said Sean.
The only people he'll talk to are you two. And we need him. Or at least the Bureau believes we do, to get to the bottom of all this, because he's the only connection we have to his old man. And the Bureau doesn't want to be seen as manhandling a kid who might have lost his soldier dad in combat.
All of which means you need us,
said Michelle.
For now, replied Littlefield, who then smiled stiffly at her, until we stop needing you.
He rose.
Now, let's go.
Where? Asked Sean.
To see the man.
FBI director?
Said Michelle.
Aim higher, said Littlefield cryptically. A lot higher.
Chapter 42.
Congratulations. It's all yours, said the man.
Alan Grant shook the man's hand and looked up at the building he had just purchased. It was an old AM radio station in rural western Fairfax County, complete with a 200-foot-high transmission tower. It had once broadcast crop and farm animal prices along with local news and weather on weak AM frequencies, but it had been unused for years. The man looked at Grant.
This thing is sort of a historical landmark around these parts.
I'm sure, said Grant.
Hope you're not going to tear it down.
Wouldn't think of it, said Grant.
Going to run your own station? You'll need to jump through lots of hoops with the FCC.
Got it all covered, thanks. The man walked to his car and drove off, leaving Grant alone with his unusual purchase. He walked the perimeter and then stopped at the tower, gazing up at its 200-foot height. Parts of it were rusty, and some cross members needed repair. He had been inside the building, which was brick with few windows and a partially rotted front door. There was lead paint and asbestos ceiling panels, but that was okay too. He didn't need to make structural changes to the place, but there would be changes, lots of them, and they needed to be done quickly. He checked his watch and then sent a text. 5 minutes later, the two tractor trailers came rolling up the winding road to the building. Three men sat in the front seat of each rig. The trucks stopped and the men got out. They opened the rear doors of the trailers and five more men jumped down from each one. With 16 men in total working, It wouldn't take them long. A ramp was dropped from each trailer, and the men started offloading building materials. Grant unlocked the door to the station, and the men began carrying in all the materials, including twin gas-powered generators. Grant consulted with his foreman, and then walked around inside the station directing the placement of the materials. Some of the other men began collecting junk and other debris from inside the old radio station and carrying it out to the trucks. The men worked steadily and methodically, and hours later, what had been in the station was now in the trucks, and what had been in the trucks was now in the station. Grant studied some plans that had been set up on a long piece of plywood, laid on sawhorses, in what had once been the lobby of the radio station. He consulted with the foreman, made notations on the construction plans, and gave some suggestions. They were on a tight schedule, and Grant was pleased to already hear the whine of power tools as the men commenced preparing the building for the required rehab. He again walked the interior with the foreman, pointing out where he wanted the vestibule walls to be. 5 layers of SID, he said, referring to security in depth. From the controlled perimeter of the guts to layer 5. The other man nodded and pointed to various spots. Intrusion detection points. Grant nodded and pointed out spots for more. They would be taking a 6-sided approach to the project, meaning all 4 walls, the ceiling, and the floor. Construction would be from true floor to true ceiling. There would be special insulation and slip-proof acoustic fill between the 1st and 2nd layers of gypsum board, with fire-rated plywood over that. Every penetration into the secure space, whether it was ductwork, utility lines, or any others, would be sealed off with acoustical foam. All ductwork would have metal bars to prevent access. All penetration lines would be configured to come in at only 1 juncture point and be properly sealed off to prevent unauthorized entry or electronic surveillance. The windows would be covered and sealed and would not open. They would be alarmed and outfitted to pass Tempest certification, as with the entire facility. There would be 1 rear emergency exit with no external hardware on the door. It would carry deadlocked panic hardware and be alarmed 24/7 with local annunciation. All doors would be nearly 2 inches thick, made of 18-gauge steel, have acoustic sweeps and seals, be self-closing and locking, have RF shielding, and be connected to alarms. The door hinges would be reinforced to 7-gauge steel, lock areas pre-drilled to 10-gauge steel, and the door closure to 12-gauge. Grant continued to walk the interior, seeing in his mind all that would be there very soon. Motion sensors, emergency backup power, access control. No one without a key card, a PIN, and the requisite biometrics on the security checklist would be admitted. Anyone else approaching the building would not have a pleasant time. A perimeter gate would be set up 200 yards down the road, and a guard stationed there. For 500 yards on all sides of the building, there would be sensors implanted in the ground, laser lines, observation posts, and every other intrusion detection device that Grant could reasonably deploy here. The exterior of the building would have enhanced noise generators and sound masking devices that would defeat any attempts to capture sensitive information. Grant ventured to the very center of the building and visualized where the vault would go. It would be a steel-lined modular room with a Class 6 entry door. This was the guts of the operation, an operation that would be taking place fairly soon. He walked outside and studied the perimeter. The best place for these types of facilities was on a military base, where you could have a dedicated response force. However, Grant did not have that option. He needed to work with what he did have, and an army he did not. He ventured over to the transmission tower. Very soon, it would have a number of satellite dishes tethered to it. They would all be beaming and receiving information through a concrete electronic pipeline of Grant's own fashioning. With that technology, he could have made billions in the business world because no one, as yet, had been able to truly protect electronic data, particularly from mobile devices, as it went from point A to point B. Wars in the future might still be fought on dirt and in the air and on the seas, but probably the most critical confrontations would take place in cyberspace, as countries used armies of cyber soldiers to attack infrastructure, power grids, financial markets, transportation and energy hubs, and more, all through the click of computer keys instead of the pull of a trigger or the drop of a bomb. What Grant was doing was akin to this type of futuristic warfare, but his target was fairly specific. In fact, it was about as focused as one could get. He finished walking the perimeter, spent a few more minutes with his men, and then drove off. He noted with satisfaction that the security perimeter was already being installed. Along with the building, Grant had also purchased 100 acres. The closest home or business was miles away. He liked his privacy. He reached the main road and sped up. He turned on the radio and found the all-news station he had been searching for a few seconds later. He waited until the top of the hour and then smiled as the lead story came on. It was the old story of a missing €1 billion along with a missing soldier. But now that story had new elements. The anchor paused for emphasis here and then announced with a flourish that information has just come to light that hints at the possibility of an illegal plot emanating from deep within the power corridors of the U.S. government, which might have serious international ramifications. Grant was glad that the story had hit all of the salient and salacious points. That had been his hope when he had it planted. He turned off the radio and sped up. He had some confidential information to purchase. But with enough money, there was nothing on Earth anymore that could be truly kept secret. Chapter 43. They were in downtown D.C. now, and the car Wingo was following swung into a parking garage. Wingo hesitated and then pulled in after it. It was a pay garage, and each driver had to get a ticket before the gate would lift. Wingo parked about 6 car spaces over from the other man. Then things got dicey. There was a bank of elevators. People were waiting for the next one. The man walked up to the queue and Wingo followed. He pulled his baseball cap down tightly over his head and adjusted his sunglasses. He was not about to take them off. He changed his appearance since Afghanistan, but he couldn't take a chance on being spotted. The group stepped onto the elevator car. It carried everyone to the lobby, where they all clambered onto another elevator. In the back, Wingo saw that the man he was following pushed the button for floor 6. When the doors opened on that floor, several other people got off as well. Wingo was the last off. He watched as the man walked down the hall and turned left. Wingo followed, stopping at the intersection of the 2 corridors. He watched as the man entered a door. It closed behind him. Wingo continued on, passed the door, and looked at the name on the wall next to the door. The Vista Trading Group, LLC. Wingo continued on down the hall and then stopped, wondering what to do. He had a gun. He could perhaps burst in and make a citizen's arrest. That, of course, would be stupid. He had no evidence. He was a wanted man himself. He had no permit for his gun. The police would come, and he would be the one arrested. He rode the elevator back down and returned to his rental. He did an internet search on the Vista Trading Group, LLC. He got the perfunctory website that told him nothing much of interest. They were engaged in defense contracting as consultants. He looked under personnel, but did not find the picture of the man he had been following. He could simply have been going there for a meeting. He didn't have to work there, Wingo concluded. This had been a dead end, but Wingo wasn't done with it yet. He would wait out on the street. When the man left, Wingo would take up the trail once more. It was then that Wingo noticed a shop across the street. He got out, ran across, and entered. 30 minutes later, he came back out and walked into the parking garage. He went over to the man's car, looked around to ensure no one was watching, and then knelt down and attached the surveillance bug under the man's bumper. Wingo quickly left the garage and got back to his car. He slid in and then powered up the device he had purchased. The shop had been one of those places that sold police scanners, handheld electronic wands that detected metal, handcuffs, police batons, and tracking devices. An hour later, the man pulled out of the garage and passed Wingo on the street. Wingo had been watching in his side mirror and sank down in his seat before the car passed. He put the car in gear and followed. He lost the car a couple of times in traffic and once when he hit a red light, but with the tracking device, he managed to regain sight of it each time. It was rush hour now. Traffic volume was heavy and corresponding speeds were slow. Wingo kept his eyes on the car as it moved along with the other traffic. He was thinking maybe the man was going back out to Dulles Airport again, because he seemed to be making his way to Interstate 66, which would tie him into the Dulles Toll Road in Virginia. If that was his destination, Wingo wasn't sure what he was going to do. When he checked his rearview mirror, he suddenly realized he would have to do something. Something drastic. It seemed that while he'd been following the guy up there, somebody else had been tailing him. SUV. Black. Tinted windows all around. The feds had a million rides like that. Was that who was back there? His own guys? After screwing him half a world away? He lost the car up ahead when he hung a left. He decided it was better to live than keep up the tail. The SUV also turned left. Okay, confirmation was nice, thought Wingo. He could almost hear the camera taking pics of his car, his plate, and the back of his head. If they were feds back there, they could pull him over and wave their badges. He would disappear forever, never see Tyler again, never prove his innocence. He sped up, took a right, and then a quick left. The SUV mimicked his maneuvers. He pushed the pedal down and risked being pulled over for speeding. He eyed up ahead, then looked to his left. To the left looked promising for three reasons. Traffic, a traffic light about to go from green to red, and most important of all, a tractor trailer about to make a wide turn. He cut the wheel and made the left. He punched the gas, eyeing the rear view at the same time. The SUV was coming on strong. They were probably planning to end this little chase right now. But Wingo had a few seconds. He would need every single one of them. He gauged the traffic light timing, the cars aligned on all sides, and the big rig making a left. The light turned yellow. One car zipped straight through the intersection, beating it. Wingo didn't want to go straight. He wanted to go left. And he wasn't waiting for the rig. In fact, he was going to jump to the front of the line. He punched the gas as he saw the yellow light flickering. Red, here we come. He laid the gas pedal flat to the floor and cut his wheel hard to the left. He shot through the intersection in front of the rig, blocking it. The truck driver slammed on his brakes, cut his wheel to the right, and laid on his horn. The semi slid sideways. The light turned red. Oncoming traffic started up, but went nowhere. The big rig was blocking the entire intersection. Horns started up from all quarters. The truck driver was no doubt delivering a few choice words in Wingo's direction. Yet Wingo was all smiles as he hung another right, then a left, and quickly made his way back to his hotel. And if they ran the plates, which he was sure they would lead to a wreck at the DC impoundment lot.
this round to me.
Chapter 44. The chopper swept over the bucolic Maryland countryside. Sean gazed out the window and then down below.
Damn, he muttered.
Michelle was sitting next to him.
What's wrong? Don't like flying in whirlybirds?
She said sarcastically. She well knew that as a Secret Service agent, Sean had flown in more copters than just about anyone outside the military.
I don't like our particular destination.
Which is?
Camp David. Michelle shot him a glance, leaned over him, and looked out the window.
Damn,
she said.
I thought I already said that, Sean shot back.
She flopped against the seat.
We're going to see POTUS? He's the man?
Apparently so.
Remember the last president you met with?
I'm hoping this one is a little better.
The chopper landed and they were escorted to the main building of heavily fortified Camp David, named after Dwight Eisenhower's grandson, and situated in Maryland's rustic Catoctin Mountains. They sat in a large room with knotty pine paneling.
You ever pull protection detail at Camp David? Sean asked Michelle.
Once, I watched the King of Jordan do some putting on the one hole they have here. It would make you wish for milk curdling as a distraction.
I'm sure it would, said the man.
Both Sean and Michelle instinctively sprang to their feet when the man entered the room. Old habits died hard. President John Cole was a bit under 6 feet and obviously fighting the battle of the waistline at age 55. Still, his shoulders were broad, his face ruggedly good-looking, his smile infectious, and he radiated impressive health and confidence.
Mr. President, Sean said, while Michelle respectfully nodded.
Please sit, said Cole.
Sean and Michelle eyed the two Secret Service agents who were escorting Cole. They had obviously been told of Sean and Michelle's Secret Service past. Michelle even recognized one of them as a former colleague, but they also knew that both agents would regard them with suspicion and would have no problem firing bullets into each of their brains if the conditions warranted such extreme force. The president was dressed informally in slacks, a polo shirt, and a blue blazer. His guards were similarly outfitted. You followed the president's fashion lead. Cole sat behind a desk while Sean and Michelle sat across from him. Cole eyed them intently. I know you had dealings with my predecessor.
Sean nodded and said, Unfortunately, yes, we did.
The truth is the truth, stated Cole, and the public at the end of the day demands that, and well they should.
Is that why we're here?
Asked Michelle.
I think you both know that it is.
Cole eyed one of his bodyguards.
Billy, you know Ms. Maxwell, I take it.
Billy eyed Michelle, gave a curt smile and a nod. Michelle skipped the smile and just returned the curt nod.
Sean said, How can we help?
Sam Wingo?
We know about his disappearance.
With over $1 billion of this country's treasure,
we've been working with his son.
I'm sure the young man is terribly worried about his father.
And you're worried that his father is a traitor, a killer, a thief, all of the above? Said Sean.
Cole put his feet up on his desk and steepled his hands.
This is not how I envisioned my first year going. I have a lot I want to do. I have some political capital with which to do it. This sort of potential scandal takes all the wind out of one's sails. Media has already started speculating. My friends on the other side of the aisle smell blood and a circling. I'm not saying anything. Want to see how it shakes out. At some point, I have to make a public statement, but before I do, I'd like to have something to say, something positive, that is. Right now, I have nothing.
Where was the money supposed to go? Asked Sean.
We understand that a bunch of Muslim insurgents from an unknown country were found dead at the rendezvous spot.
We prefer to call them freedom fighters, said Cole.
Although over there, your ally at breakfast is your enemy before dinner, so I'm not sure how valid that description of them is. Nonetheless, I made the bed. Now I have to sleep in it. Sean said, "So the money was meant for them, to help in the fight against an Islamic government. Which one?" "I can't disclose to you the name of the country. I'm sorry. Neither of you would be privy to any of this, but for your relationship with Tyler Wingo."
"And you need him?"
"I need his father. I need his father to tell me where the hell the money is and what the hell happened over there. If he's turned against us, we have to track him and the money down. If he's innocent, we still need him to come in and explain what happened." "Do you think he's innocent?" asked Sean. "The betting here is running about 9-1 against him," said Cole frankly. "Personally, I don't know. He was vetted for the mission, outscored everyone else. Patriotism above reproach, all that, but the proof is in the pudding. The money is gone. The freedom fighters are dead. And the longer Wingo stays away, the more we're going to assume he's against us. Just human nature."
"He might be afraid to come in,"
said Michelle.
"He might believe he was set up and doesn't know who to trust."
"Has he made contact with anyone at DOD? Asked Sean. "His field superior, Colonel South."
"And what did he tell South?"
"He told South that he was set up, that someone ostensibly from the CIA met him at the rendezvous spot, told him the mission had been changed, and demanded the money at gunpoint." "Was the person from the CIA?" asked Sean. "Neither we've been able to discover. Wingo was attached to DIA, and while DIA has been working more closely with CIA, they were not in this instance. The loop was small and closed. DIA and me. And while it's true that Langley is always demanding more budget dollars, I can't believe they would resort to stealing from Peter to pay Paul in order to get it," Cole added dryly.
"Did Wingo give any indication to South where he might go or what he might do?"
"Apparently he wants to prove his innocence. Where that takes him, I don't know." "I guess that partly depends on who set him up," reasoned Sean.
"If someone set him up," amended Cole. "We only have his word for that. And I'm still missing €1 billion.
And euros were used for an additional layer of cover.
Ben Franklin's might have been a little too obvious. And there was a very practical reason. $1 billion in $100 bills, which is the largest denomination we use, would have weighed a lot more than 4,800 pounds. "Which brings us back to what you want us to do," said Sean. "You have Tyler Wingo's loyalties by all accounts. We believe that his father will try to contact him again. They'll want to meet. We need to be there when they do."
"So you want us to deliver Sam Wingo to you using his son to do it?"
"That's basically the plan, yes. I've been told the boy will say nothing to my people. You're the only ones he trusts."
"And if we betray that trust?"
said Michelle, her voice rising just enough for the two Secret Service agents to draw a step closer to them. "Better than betraying your country," pointed out Cole. "Was Gene Wingo part of this?" asked Sean. Cole nodded, but tacked nothing on in speech. "She's disappeared. We know that." "But she didn't come into you?" asked Sean. Cole shook his head. "So she might have another partner in this deal?"
"Like Sam Wingo?"
shot back Cole.
"I didn't say that."
"No, I did. So, will you help me?" Michelle looked at Sean, and Sean looked at her. He said, "We need to talk about this."
"I can give you a few minutes alone," said Cole.
"We're going to need longer than that,"
said Michelle, while Sean looked at her nervously. Cole raised both eyebrows and then gazed for a long moment at the ceiling. He rose with an extremely disappointed look on his face.
"I expected better, I really did. I assumed that a direct appeal from your commander-in-chief would carry the day. I could have pushed you off to a lower-level flunky, but
I flew you up here to go eyeball to eyeball. To tell you that your country needs you. He paused. And you tell me you have to talk about it. He shook his head disgustedly. Well, I guess they don't make them the way they used to.
We're between a rock and a hard place, Mr. President, Sean said by way of explanation. It's not as cut and dried as it may seem.
Billy here will show you out. Thanks for humoring me. I'll await your answer. With this curt dismissal, Sean and Michelle turned to the door. As Billy walked them down the hall, Michelle said,
How's your family doing, Billy?
Fine.
I remember your wife had a rough pregnancy.
She's fine.
Okay.
Michelle waited, but the question never came. Finally, she said,
Just so you know, I'm fine, too.
They got back on the chopper. As soon as the door closed, it lifted off. Sean and Michelle settled into their seats and strapped on their belts.
Well, now I know what it's like being cold-cocked by the president.
Sean shrugged. What did you expect? A medal for meritorious service? His ass is in the fire. He's looking for any way to put the flames out. That's why he let us leapfrog the normal chain of command.
And it's our fault all this shit happened?
We made the choice, so I'd say we're partly accountable.
We were helping a kid find his dad, Sean. I never expected this to become an international incident.
He sighed. I know. Neither did I. But now we've got the most powerful man in the world pissed off at us. That's cause for worry in my book. A big worry. Chapter 45. When they returned to FBI headquarters, Sean asked Agent Littlefield to take them to see Tyler. The expression on Littlefield's face was not encouraging. Sean said angrily, Look, you have no right to keep us from seeing him. He's probably scared out of his mind right now.
I wouldn't know if he was or not, said Littlefield evasively.
Michelle said,
And why would that be? Can't you just ask him?
Littlefield said nothing. He simply aimed his gaze at a spot on the ceiling and seemed to be pretending Sean and Michelle weren't even there. Sean looked at her. I think he's sending us a telepathic message.
Okay, let's see if we can grab the signal.
She put a finger to her forehead and closed her eyes.
Wait for it. Wait for it. Okay, it's coming.
She leaned down and got right in Littlefield's face, her hands on her hips.
How the hell did the FBI manage to lose a 16-year-old kid?
Now Littlefield met her eye.
We had no reason to believe he was going to make a break for it.
And you had no reason to believe he wasn't either, Sean pointed out. But from the WFO, really?
How?
Demanded Michelle.
Does it matter? Asked Littlefield.
It might just help us find him.
Littlefield slumped in his chair.
He said he was hungry, wanted a hot dog and curly fries from the vendor outside. He also wanted some air. Send one of the old codgy uniforms with him. Our guy had two dogs and a pack of fries in his hands and was trying to pay for the food when the kid took off across the street like a rocket, right in the middle of rush hour. In less than a minute, he was gone. Our guy said the boy could flat out run.
Yeah. He's 16 freaking years old with long legs. And he's on the swim team, which means he has tons of endurance. But I'm sure you knew all that. Which makes me wonder why you sent an old codger out with him in the first place.
He wasn't under arrest. He wasn't being detained.
It was your job to keep him safe. Now he could be anywhere, including dead.
Okay, I get all that, said Littlefield miserably. I screwed up.
He looked from one to the other.
So what now?
Now we find Tyler before some other folks do, said Sean. He added, I'm assuming we're free to go?
For the time being. But I'll feel a lot better if I send some agents with you. For personal protection, of course.
No offense, but the Secret Service does personal protection a lot better than you. So we're good to go.
So what did the president want with you two? Asked Littlefield.
Michelle said,
To congratulate us on our work to date.
Cut the crap. What did he want?
He wanted us to do something, said Sean, and we're thinking about it.
The president asked you to do something and you're thinking about it? Littlefield said incredulously.
You know, that's exactly how he sounded, too. Well, take care. We'll be going now.
She put her hand on the knob and eyed Sean. An invisible message seemed to have been telegraphed between them. Sean said,
We'll keep you abreast of our investigation, if you do the same.
You know I can't promise that, said Littlefield.
Good, said Sean.
Then we'll keep you in the dark on ours, too.
They left.
As they walked down the hall, Michelle said,
Where do you think Tyler went?
He got a message back from his dad. My guess is he got another one. Sean was already pulling his phone out and checking the back door he had established on Tyler's Gmail account. And there it is. And unfortunately, it's not in code.
Why unfortunately? If it's not coded, we should be able to break it easily, even without Edgar.
You'd think, wouldn't you?
He handed her the phone. She eyed the screen, reading the short email. Tonight at 10. Usual place.
Usual place,
said Michelle, her brow furrowed.
Seemingly straightforward information without context is better than code, noted Sean. There's no logical way to crack it, because we don't know where the usual place is.
Sure there is,
countered Michelle, tossing him back his phone. He caught it and stared at her as she sped up on her way out of WFO. They had to take a taxi back to Sean's house because the FBI had refused, or at least Littlefield had refused, them a ride back. Michelle sat impatiently in the back seat, urging the cab driver to run red lights, break the speed limit, and come as close as possible to side-swiping cars that refused to get out of the way.
In other words, said Sean, you want him to drive just like you?
Basically, yeah.
And why the rush?
Got an idea? We need to talk to someone.
Who?
The only person I know who can give us some context and help us understand that email.
They returned to Sean's house and climbed immediately into Michelle's Land Cruiser. Sean had to kick junk and trash off the floorboard so his feet would have a place to rest. Some of the stuff fell outside on the driveway as he closed the door.
Just so you know, he said, I am not picking that up.
Good boy, Sean. Glad to see you're being a little less of a neatnik. It shows personal growth and maturity.
You know, that was not my point. He didn't finish because she had backed the truck out of his driveway at about 80 miles an hour before slamming it into drive and hurtling off. She started tapping the steering wheel with her fingers, moving her head from side to side and smiling.
You really get high from this stuff, don't you? He observed, watching her.
What stuff?
Speed, danger, being stupid.
You lost me on that last one.
So the context? Fill me in.
Kathy Burnett. They grew up together. They're tight. I'm betting if anyone can tell us where the usual place is for Tyler and his dad, it will be her.
That's actually quite insightful, Michelle.
I thought so.
She glanced at him.
But if we do guess right and we catch up to Sam Wingo, what then?
I've been running those scenarios in my head. He's officially wanted by the authorities. Our duty should be clear.
Our duty is never clear.
This is very true.
So again, what do we do?
I don't have a clear answer. A lot depends on what Sam Wingo's story is.
He's Special Forces, Sean. Selected for a pretty classified project and survived what looked to be an ambush and a bunch of people dead. Guy clearly has incredible skills. If he's gone bad...
Then we'll have to tread carefully.
Maybe more than that.
He looked at her. What do you mean?
Sean, we might have to be prepared to kill him before he kills us.
Kill him? Right in front of his son?
It's not my first choice, obviously.
Sean stared at the scenery passing by them at 80 miles an hour. Chapter 46.
Usual place?
Repeated Kathy Burnett. She was standing on her front porch while Sean and Michelle stood opposite her. They had gotten here in record time. Once Sean thought a cop was going to take up the chase when they flew past his position, but he just stayed where he was. Sean thought it might be because he was doubtful he could catch them.
Right. The usual place,
said Michelle.
Some place that Tyler and his dad might go to meet, talk, do something together. Why don't you just ask Tyler?
She said, a bit suspiciously, Sean thought. Before Michelle could answer, he said, This is for down the road, Kathy. It's just background work that all detectives do. We're simply building a file on everyone, and that includes their likes and dislikes, preferences, typical meeting places. It might not matter now, but it could later on. It's as much for Tyler's protection as anything. Michelle shot him a glance, but his gaze remained fixed on Kathy. He was hoping she would not think too much about this avalanche of words, because if she did, the girl would realize they made no sense at all. Kathy nodded slowly.
Okay, I guess I can see that.
Sean let out an inaudible breath of relief. But nothing is coming to you? Michelle said,
I saw fishing poles leaning against the wall in the laundry room when I was over there.
Kathy looked exasperated with herself.
Of course. They used to go to fish at a place on the river near here. Well, it's not much more than a creek, really, but they've caught stuff there, and Tyler and his dad would just hang out and talk. I've been there twice with Tyler, but I'm not into fishing. I'd just watch and we'd talk.
Sean whipped out his notepad and a pen. Can you tell us exactly where it is? She gave him directions. They thanked her and headed back to the Land Cruiser. Give me the keys, Sean said.
What?
The keys, he said again, snapping his fingers.
Why?
Because our timetable does not allow for us to be stopped by the police for speeding or otherwise reckless driving.
We weren't stopped on the way over here, were we?
By the grace of God, I can't count on that happening again. Keys, please. She tossed them to him so hard one of them cut his finger. Thanks, he said tersely. They climbed in and drove off. Michelle checked her watch.
7:30 already. It's going to be tight. Sure you don't want me to drive?
Very sure, thanks. He sped off and followed the turns. Michelle fed him from his notes.
What's our plan?
Asked Michelle as Sean hung a hard left and pressed the gas pedal back down. We have to assume Sam Wingo will come in armed and paranoid. He'll trust his son, of course, but he won't trust anyone else.
We can't play judge, jury, and executioner, Sean, not on the spot.
Hell, you were the one saying we might have to kill him.
I also said it was not my first choice.
We have to control the situation. Then we have to get him to trust us.
I don't see either one of those objectives being easily accomplished.
They won't be.
But if he came back for his son, isn't that pretty strong proof he's innocent?
Sean looked at her. Maybe. But it's not conclusive proof, Michelle. And don't forget, if he was set up, then whoever did set him up will not want him to be able to come back and talk to anyone.
And if we're in the middle of that?
Hell, we're already in the middle of that. Michelle pulled her gun from its holster, checked to make sure a round was chambered, and put it away. She let out a long breath.
What if Wingo doesn't come alone?
Who else?
Assuming he's not innocent.
Sean nodded, looking thoughtful. The problem is he knows this fishing hole place better than we do.
Yeah, but I bet he hasn't been trained to scope a place in about 6 seconds like we have.
We're going to have to split up on this. I'll be the contact person. You cover me.
Why not the other way around?
He smiled. I'm not too proud to admit that you're a better shot than I am. She looked in the back of her truck.
I've got my sniper rifle back there.
Good. We might just need it.
You think Tyler has doubts about his dad?
Sean shook his head. No, he obviously idolizes the guy. I just hope the sergeant doesn't disappoint in the hero department. He looked up ahead. We're going to find out soon enough. That's the turn off for the road to the fishing hole. We're going to park up the road a ways. The last thing I want is for Tyler to spot your truck. We'll backtrack, do a recon,